Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
On the 7th of October 2023, Rachel Lester, originally from Los Angeles, was called up for reserve duty. Having served previously in the IDF Spokespersons Unit International Division, she launched Rachel in Reserves on Instagram, documenting her life as reality of the war unfolded. Her content reached millions of viewers worldwide, helping bring an Israeli perspective to international audiences. She has been recognized for her role as a digital warrior, and I'm absolutely delighted to have Rachel as my guest to tell me more. Rachel, welcome, and thanks so much for joining me.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Rachel, firstly, tell me, where were you on October the 7th?
So on October 7th, I was in my apartment in Tel Aviv. I felt the boom hit and the walls were shaking, my bed was shaking, and I thought, there's no way this is a terrorist attack. I convinced myself it was an earthquake, and I went back to sleep. And I woke up again to, you know, messages checking in on me, and I finally realized that something serious was going on, and I checked the news, and immediately my first reaction was to contact my commander in the army and say, hey, I'm here as soon as you need me. I can get to base in 10 minutes. Let me be part of this. Let me help. And I went into reserves the next day, and I served for more than six months after October 7th.
Wow, continuously straight after that time, which must have been the most difficult emotionally and physically draining.
It was very draining. The first couple months, we were working 12-hour shifts, or like, you know, from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., and I was working every minute of every day. We didn't get weekends off. We were on base, you know, for so long, working really hard. And I was one of the people who had to go through all of Hamas's footage on Telegram, showing every single detail of the massacre, all of the people that they murdered and attacked and kidnapped. It was my job to, well, I volunteered for the job because I didn't want anybody else to have to see it, but I went through every single video that Hamas ever posted and that was gathered by car dash cams and CCTV footage, and made, you know, content out of the horrible atrocity footage, and basically showed the world what Hamas is really, you know, really did, and show why Israel had to fight back.
Rachel, I cannot even begin to imagine what that must have been like. Tell me a little bit about emotionally what, I mean, especially when you talk about how you, typical of so many Israelis, couldn't really comprehend what was actually happening at the time, and then to have to watch it like that.
I think we comprehended pretty well what was going on because there was just so much video going around. I think that maybe in abroad, they didn't know what was going on because the news wasn't necessarily covering exactly what was going on. But yeah, it was just a very emotional time. And every time the death toll went up, we just got more upset and more upset. And we tried to channel that into our work by making content for IDF's international social media pages to understand why we were fighting, why we were about to go into Gaza, why we had to eliminate Hamas. So I'm really glad that Hamas filmed all of their atrocities, because without that footage, we wouldn't have been able to tell the world what actually happened.
Rachel, what was the process, the thinking process behind deciding what footage can and should be used, and the ethical ideas around sharing something that is so incredibly awful and personal to the victim?
Yeah, so something that is both very admirable and, from my perspective, frustrating about the IDF and Israeli society is that everybody who was hurt, injured, or killed or kidnapped on October 7th was somebody's friend, mother, son, daughter, wife, husband, and Israelis react really strongly to seeing bloody footage of them being massacred. So after the first few weeks of the war, the higher ups in the unit actually made us stop showing graphic footage in our content because it was just too traumatizing for Israeli society. And I was very actively trying to fight against that because I kept saying, the only way that we have legitimacy to fight in Gaza and to be killing Hamas leaders and terrorists is to show the world over and over, don't forget, this is what a Hamas did on October 7th. So a couple days into the war, I made a YouTube compilation of like 10 minutes of everything that I thought was reasonable to put on YouTube. Some things I did not include. I didn't include bloody soldiers. I thought that would be too much of a morale destroyer for the country to see our soldiers hurt. But I did my best to compile all of the, you know, the aftermath of the houses and the yards and the kitchens that were, you know, covered in blood. The walkways, I remember like trails of blood. Then after a few months, there was more footage that had come out of just hundreds of bodies at the Nova Festival. And I remember that I was told to blur it very strongly because people just, like, you know, Israelis and Jews just couldn't see it anymore. But I think it's really important to show and watch that footage if you can, because, you know, that's our whole justification for fighting against Hamas, is making sure that never happens again.
I know you're very involved in the communication, and you were working in the IDF spokesperson's unit, which means you will know the balances, and you've just spoken about one, between what you put out, what you can say. When you consider that you're fighting a war on the media front, which is a completely different war with completely different rules of engagement,
yeah.
And when I have that quote, when it takes a lie, what a lie can run around the world before truth has already put its boots on.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that kind of unfair playing field?
Yeah, you're right. It's a completely unfair playing field. And what we saw in the aftermath of October 7th is that Hamas can just lie, make up numbers, make up events, make up statistics, and the world will believe it without questioning the source. And what we see is that when the IDF comes out to fact check it after the fact, people are very skeptical to believe us, which it's just so unfair that people believe a terrorist organization and don't believe the Israeli army. The best example of this, which I wrote about in my book very in great detail, was the night of the Al Ali hospital explosion, which was a misfired rocket from Islamic Jihad. And it took the IDF 4 hours to confirm that it wasn't us and that it was actually a misfired rocket, but from a terrorist organization. And it's really tough because there were so many times where people in the unit were begging for us to put out a statement saying it wasn't us, but we didn't know for 100% fact until 4 hours after the event had happened. And, you know, some people say you have to be faster. People complain that we're not fast enough, that we're not playing the social media game well enough, but we also can't afford to take any hits to our accuracy, because if we had actually been the ones to have that rocket be our responsibility, and we said it wasn't, then that lie would have, I mean, it's not like people find the IDF to be so, you know, they don't trust the IDF for whatever their reasons are, but that would have destroyed all of our credibility if we had tried to go any faster. So we just, you know, to answer your question about how do we fight this unfair playing field, we just go as fast as we can, and we try to make sure that we're checking every box of where we check. In my book, I go through exactly what was going on, like every minute of those 4 hours, and who was checking where, and who was, you know, trying to figure out from what source we could say that it wasn't us. We just do the best we can, but sometimes it's true. If it's not fast enough, we don't get believed, and that is just a really unfair reality.
I do want to pick up your point about how quickly and easily people will believe Hamas, but the IDF remains like questionable. I just remember, like, post the war, having a discussion with the mainstream radio station, and the guy said to me, "Why should we believe your facts over anybody else's facts?" And I think that really raises the question about facts. Actually, what are we actually Where is reality and truth, or is there none in the Middle East, and is it just an emotional war?
It really is an emotional war. I think one of the many reasons that the Palestinians have such good PR is that they're always using emotional manipulation to, you know, seem like they're on the right side. They're always crying on the news. They're always, you know, something I noticed, and it's also something I wrote about in my book, is that immediately after October 7th, the Israelis who went on the news that were presenting facts and being, you know, very logical and tough and resilient, they didn't come across as the victims. They came across as, you know, we were hit badly, but we're going to overcome it. And before Israel even retaliated, there were Palestinians on international news crying and, you know, being very emotional. And I think that one of the major things that Israelis have to figure out how to change is for us to be more emotionally open and humanize ourselves, even if it makes us look weak, because really wars are, the online wars are fought with emotion, not facts. And we see that we have all the facts on our side, but at the end of the day, no one wants to hear them.
Yeah, it's really, really tough. I also want to talk about, pick up on a point that you raised regarding if a mistake is made, and this wasn't a mistake made by the IDF, but I do want to talk about the, I think it was the decapitated babies, because this is something that is brought up to show that the IDF and those in support of Israel lie and lie and lie. Do you want to talk that through? Because you must have been getting a lot of images and a lot of different kind of information.
Yeah, I'm not the most educated on the specific event of the alleged decapitated babies. I know that it didn't come from the IDF. It came from, as far as I'm aware, a medic or a someone who was doing, who was gathering the bodies. And it was, I think, later debunked. I think that it came to be that claim was maybe taken out of context or misconstrued or something like that. But yeah, it's a really unfortunate reality that one piece of information can go viral, and then, you know, if it turns out to not be true, then it ruins all of Israel's credibility, as opposed to when Hamas says something that clearly isn't true, you know, and they're caught in a lie day after day, it doesn't hurt their credibility. So it's just a really, as we said before, it's just a really unfair playing field that Hamas is able to lie, and when Israel makes a mistake, we don't get the same, you know, kind judgment.
Let's talk a little bit about your choice of media, which is Instagram. Why Instagram? And tell me how the response has been.
So I decided to make an Instagram account a few days into the war, maybe October 10th or so. I felt like Twitter is mostly a place for journalists and, you know, sharing straight news. I wanted to be active on TikTok, but they kept banning my account every time I posted footage from the massacre. So I kind of gave up on TikTok. But Instagram is a platform where I think people are more willing to hear out things that aren't necessarily on their side. And it's a platform for people to really take advantage of, like, the fact that people are a little bit less educated or less set in their ways. And I've just gotten such positive feedback on the videos that I make for Instagram, because, you know, on Twitter, you can follow tons of content creator of, you know, personalities on Twitter that share pro-Israel stuff, but on Instagram there's a lot less of it to see. So when I made videos that were debunking lies, they did really well and people were really supportive. That being said, I do get countless death threats, hate messages, hate comments, and I don't mind those at all, because it just means that I'm reaching outside of the Jewish bubble and reaching accounts that are on the other side. So they don't bother me.
Let's talk a little bit about the youth on Instagram and whether you feel that, again, coming from this idea of spokespersons unit, whether you feel that enough energy and attention is given to social media specifically for the youth.
Yeah, absolutely not. One of the things that I write about in my book is about how the social media faces are all white, like they all feed into this white colonizer narrative. And it's really important to me that the IDF and that Israel in general invests more in young people and training and educating young people to be able to fight for Israel among their peers, because the older people who are all, you know, grew up in a generation where Israel was the underdog, those aren't changing hearts and minds of young people. So I definitely think that we need to, you know, focus on training young people to fight the battle with us.
Before we talk about your book, and I do want to talk about your book, I do, very quick question. Do you think coming from America gives you a different insight than Israelis would have?
Absolutely. I think I'm very fortunate to come from the U.S. I was born and raised in L.A., in a very pro-Israel environment. And then I went off to college and I saw how much hate there was for Israel for the first time. And I learned a lot about how regular Americans, especially young people, think about Israel, or don't think about Israel, they think about the Palestinians. And I think I have a very unique ability to relate what's going on in Israel to the audience that I grew up with. And I think it's a big problem in the, like, let's say in the spokesperson's unit, where it's mostly Israelis fighting for American audience, fighting to reach the American audience, and it's a lot of messaging coming from the higher ups who are more concerned with the Hebrew media, and just kind of regurgitating it in English. But like, I was actually on English social media, seeing what Americans were actually talking about and directing my content to answer their real questions, not what the IDF thinks they want to hear.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about, thank you for that insight, by the way. That was great insight. Let's talk about your book.
Sure. So I just wrote a book that came out last week. I'm very proud of it. It's called Digital Warrior, Inside Israel's Battle for the Narrative After October 7th. So the backstory is that when I was finished with 6 months of reserves and I went back to LA and I did a little bit of speaking to groups, somebody came up to me after my first event and said, "Wow, this is so interesting. Your story is so unique. You have to write a book." And I kind of just thought, should I write a book? So I did. It's, as I said, as you can figure out from the title, it's about my experience fighting what we call the digital war. It's a memoir style, like a journal style, of going through every day of the war. I mean, not every single day, but going through the beginning of the war, like every single day. And then as time passed, things are a little bit more spread out. Basically just sharing my experience of what was I doing? How did it feel? What was going through my head when I was making decisions about the videos that I was making? What was going on in the unit during specific events? And really just kind of giving people the first ever inside look into, you know, the behind the scenes of the social media war being fought from the IDF itself.
I don't know.
It's available on Amazon. It's available on Kindle. You can just search Digital Warrior. And I would love for people in South Africa to pick it up and give it a read.
Thank you so much. It sounds like an absolutely must read. And also give people an insight into what was actually happening from somebody who was there, which is quite unique. Was it therapeutic for you?
I wouldn't call it therapeutic exactly. It was more that I just felt really passionate about getting my experience and messages out there to the world. It made me kind of, once I had everything put together in a book, I was able to see patterns and, you know, things that we did well and things that we didn't do well, and things that we can improve for next time. And it was just a really meaningful experience to write my book. Maybe it was therapeutic, but it was very, very meaningful, that's for sure.
Well, thank you so much for joining me and for sharing and for letting us know about your book. And I'm sure it'll make an extremely moving and insightful read.
Thank you so much.
That was Rachel Lester, and she has just brought out a book. She's a digital warrior, and she recounts her story as being in the IDF as a reservist post October the 7th.